Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to the New Books in History, a channel in the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host for this episode. I am here today with the great Dr. Ara Merjan, professor of Italian studies and an affiliate of the Institute of Fine Arts and the Department of History at NYU. He's the author of Giorgio di Chirico and the Metaphysical City, Nietzsche, Modernism, Paris, for out with Yale University Press in 2014, and the book we'll be discussing today, Against the Avant-Garde, Pier Paolo Pasolini, Contemporary Art and Neocapitalism, out with the University of Chicago Press in 2020. Hello, Ara. I'm so happy to be talking to you today. How are you?
Hi, Yana. I'm terrific. I'm really happy to be with you as well.
Wonderful news. How's New York?
It's doing pretty well. It was touch and go in the spring and early summer, but the last few months, there's been a degree of normality back, people eating outside, people going to the gym again. Things are still strange, but hopefully we can keep our numbers good as they've been. How are things on your side of the pond?
It is not good in Amsterdam. We're back under second lockdown, basically. But we'll see. We're all optimistic. It's funny, right? We're getting to see how people are really adaptable. I remember vaguely riding my bicycle to work. I'll do it again, right?
You will.
Yeah, we will. Oh, it's fine. It's a blustery, beautiful evening in Amsterdam, and it's kind of perfect. It's the perfect time to talk about sunbaked Italy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because that's what you think about with the art that we're going to talk about today, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so my very first question is really kind of broad. So how did you get here? So you study 20th century Italy, focusing on artistic expression of several kinds and philosophy, and specifically a group of kind of pensive, moody, artistic Mediterranean men. So on some level, it was probably inevitable that you were going to get to Pasolini.
Yeah, but, that's interesting. I mean, di Chirico was, Pasolini's a tough character to study, but di Chirico was a real curmudgeon. So in some ways, it was a nice change. In some ways, it was even harder because I have such enormous respect for Pasolini that whenever you are dealing with someone critically, it's important not to be sort of seduced by their cult of personality. So while politically I shared so much more with Pasolini than with the patrician Nietzschean di Chirico, it had its own challenges. But, I suppose the way that I got there was in graduate school, I took a seminar my first year on Italian neorealism and Marxism, and I really got into the history of Italian aesthetics of the 20th century through the cinema to start with. And so in some ways, this was kind of a return to that early study after I finished the di Chirico project, and I've always been drawn to Pasolini for a number of different reasons, which obviously we'll get to. So the project was kind of on the back burner in the back of my mind for many years. And as we'll talk about, Pasolini studied at university with a great Italian historian, Roberto Longhi, one of the most distinguished critics and art historians in Italy's 20th century. So as an art historian who teaches in an Italian department now at NYU, I was able to come at the project from a couple of different angles, and it allowed me to kind of put interdisciplinarity into practice, I suppose.
Yeah, that works. That makes perfect sense. And he's such an important figure, and he's so this mesmerizing, polarizing. Everyone has an opinion on Pasolini, I think. I was really excited to read this and hear your take. So before we get into the meat of the book and your arguments, I want to talk about your source material and your methodology. So, you know, the phrase dizzying array is a cliche, but I felt that on this kind of atomic level when I was trying to just catalog in my head your references. You start with a Monty Python skit and go from there. So do you want to comment on this?
Yes,
can you tell it?
That's a terrific question. It's funny, you know, in the United States, Pasolini is known chiefly as a filmmaker. He made his first feature film in the early 1960s, and that's really what led to his fame on this side of the Atlantic. To some degree, also for literary folk, they know him also as a poet. In Italy, and to a great extent in France, he was known for all of the other vocations which he maintained simultaneously, which was everything from playwright to film theorist to polemicist to journalist to political gadfly, to painter himself. Actually, he was a, I would say, dilettante painter who intermittently engaged with the practice starting from his late adolescence, abandoning it at some point in the late 50s, early 60s, and then taking it up again in a number of instances. And so the fact that he had this art historical training, but was also a practicing painter to some degree and left literature essentially for a time to pursue the cinema, meant that inevitably there were going to be all of these different threads. The angle from which I was coming, and of course, you know, as you said, because he's such a prominent and polemical figure, there are entire libraries now on Pasolini's work. So my particular line of inquiry was his relationship, his deeply fraught and ambivalent and productively ambivalent relationship to what we would call the art world. And so as you noted, that really encompassed and comprised everything from kind of more popular, parodic references to him in Monty Python sketches to the more kind of granular level of his own film theory and how that related to contemporary aesthetics. And so everything from, I guess, the high to low. I mean, Pasolini at one point himself acknowledges that his work is what he calls extravagantly interdisciplinary. And if I have retained even the faintest whiff of that in the book, I'll be proud, because it really is in some ways difficult to pigeonhole him or to limit him to one genre or medium or discourse. And yet at the same time, there are some really kind of consistent threads in his work. And, you know, one of them is this profound dedication to figurative, what he would call plastic representation, that he really approaches representation through figurative depictions of the body. And so throughout the 60s, when painting began to become essentially under fire with the neo-avant-garde as a kind of outmoded and even reactionary practice, he still clung to painting as a reference point for his cinema, just as his more confessional and lyrical poetry chafed against the grain of neo-avant-garde literature, which insisted that poets engage with popular culture, with consumerism, the notion essentially that that language now is inevitably infected, even high language, by the most lowbrow of technocratic and consumerist discourses. And yet he, again, stubbornly clung to lyrical poetry as another kind of redoubt or a realm, an embattled fortress realm against what he saw to be the horrors of consumerist culture.
I'm clenching my fists along with him in this fight. Is it charming? Is that annoying? I don't know. But I mean, I guess that's the question, right?
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that because, you know, he lived his aesthetic and political struggle on the level of the body. And that is something that, you know, I talk about in the fourth chapter on performance. In fact, there is a whole theory by his lifelong friend who was a painter and communist from the same region, Friuli, Giuseppe Zigaina, who even had this, in my opinion, deeply fanciful and overwrought and ultimately misguided theory that Pasolini's death, when he was killed in the wee hours of the morning on a beach near Ostia, on the coast outside of Rome by a hustler with whom he had had a sexual tryst. Zigaina essentially elaborated this entire theory that even Pasolini's death was willed by him, even perhaps planned by him, as a culmination of a performative existence. And so we even have Pasolini starring in films. He stars in a film in the early 1960s called Il Gobbo, the Hunchback, and he plays a partisan fighter who is essentially crucified by these fascist interrogators. And it's impossible not to read his life through these terms as a kind of martyr. And in fact, his own death, as we'll talk about, remains under the shadow of lingering, stubborn doubt as to whether or not it was this one soul hustler who murdered him, or whether he was operating with the, you know, physical and moral support of neo-fascist forces who were, you know, greatly disgruntled with Pasolini's relentless ideological battle. So it was a battle that he really lived on the level of the body. So to the extent that you're clenching your fist, I in fact have a close-up of Pasolini's fist clenched as he is performing this scene as a partisan being interrogated. And in some ways, you know, the boundaries between his life and his art were continually worn away. And, you know, in a sense, his life does become this performative, you know, there's actually a newspaper front page from this journal Lo Specchio from 1962. And it shows Pasolini hitting back against people in this crowd who physically attacked him after the screening of Mamma Roma, which was his second feature-length film. And, you know, the headline says, slaps for Pasolini, hanno applaudito Mamma Roma sulla faccia del regista. So they applauded Pasolini on his face with slaps, meaning that, you know, even their clapping was essentially something that he received physically as a form of violence. So I'm thrilled to hear that you're clenching your fist, and it's very, very appropriate.
Wonderful. All right. You know, from there, it's a really easy, like, you've already brought up a lot of what I want you to talk about. What I want to hear about is kind of the Pasolini quandary is that he's extremely difficult to capture, right, by his contemporaries, by scholar sense. I think the Pasolini worshippers would call him ineffable. You seem to be much less interested in maintaining the cult, which is nice. But the difficulty of wrapping your arms around him, much less your brain, I think is interesting. So, but I'm curious to hear what you would describe as the fundamental question you're trying to answer here.
Yeah, that's it's a tough thing to encapsulate, but you're right that there is up front there is the kind of hagiographic Pasolini, in which he is made a martyr not only to his own cause, not only to his own life, essentially, for which he, you know, paid again on the level of his own body, but teasing that out to the extent that we can from his aesthetic and ideological and even ethical imperatives of a larger project. And what I was most interested in was this paradox that we think of Pasolini as the most iconoclastic, heterodox, avant-garde individuals of the later part of the second half of the 20th century. And yet his aesthetics and to some degree his ideological principles remain deeply conservative. So I really wanted to, I suppose, ply that paradox to really home in on the extent to which it's strange or not strange so much as remarkable and significant and profound that an individual who was so embattled against the avant-garde on an ideological, what he saw on an ideological level, was also a lightning rod for that same avant-garde. I mean, and we see that to a great extent at the end of the book where, you know, the catalog of artists working today on Pasolini is just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, artists as diverse as William Kentridge to Paul Chan, from Richard Serra to Grazia Toderi. But even during his lifetime, his cinema, his poetry was something that we obviously, is something that's part of, you know, the long arc of modernism. And he, you know, he claimed to have been converted to poetry by Rimbaud and Baudelaire. So he was someone that was long steeped in what we would call the avant-garde in aesthetic terms. And yet at the same time, incorporated avant-garde elements to ends which oftentimes went against the grain of what we would consider the neo-avant-garde after World War II. So, you know, why is it that this individual who we think of as so radical in his politics can be so, at the same time, conservative in some of his aesthetic penchants, and yet at the same time exploit certain avant-garde tendencies? That's what I really wanted to get at, is the extent to which what we take for granted as a kind of neat lineup between avant-garde aesthetics and leftist politics can actually be much more nuanced and complex and to some extent paradoxical.
Wonderful. All right. So then you go about answering this question with what are essentially case studies in order, abstraction, pa, parte, povera, and performance. And I'm interested in why you chose these areas, but let's go into arte povera in detail. Talk to me about why what you wanted to do with arte povera and why you chose that this movement.
Sure. By way of talking about that, it would help to have a little bit of background on his own origins, which bear significantly upon his relationship to arte povera, which was in many ways a non-relationship. I don't believe Pasolini even knew that arte povera existed. I don't think he certainly never mentioned it in any of his writings or interviews, and he remained kind of willfully, proudly ignorant of contemporary artistic trends. And yet, as I examine in the book, there are significant overlaps, both biographical but also intellectual and aesthetic ones, between both of those projects. But one of the key elements of Pasolini's own biography, which bears upon his relationship to arte povera, is that he, after moving around a great deal in his youth with a father who was actually served in the fascist infantry, and a mother who was from Friuli, which is a province north of Venice in northeastern Italy, the family settled down in this region of Friuli, which was the native region of his mother, for whom he had a lifelong, almost preternatural attachment. And he really sunk his roots into this region in a way that was, again, almost bodily, sensory, on the level of the textures of peasant life, the smells, but also on the level of language. Friuli has its own dialect, Friulano, which is to some degree its own language, and a language in which Pasolini wrote a lot of his earlier poetry as an adolescent. And basically what he did was he elevated this this dialect, which was a, you know, conversational vernacular, to the level of quote unquote high literature by writing lyrical poetry in it. And his attachment to the peasantry, to day laborers and farm workers, both politically, because he was from very early on an avid member of the Communist Party, of the local Communist Party, for which he gave addresses and went to youth conferences, but also on a bodily and erotic level. He was someone who was always attracted to sort of the more rough and humble types from, you know, the start of his erotic life. And in many ways, he came to graft those penchants and desires onto the Roman Borgata, which, for those who are not familiar with the term, is essentially sort of the outskirts of, on the city of Rome, the slums, the shanty towns in which the sort of disaffected communities live, cut off from the city's services and institutions, linguistically different, with a very strong Roman vernacular. And it was here that Pasolini lived for a time after he fled to Rome. He was kicked out of the Communist Party. He was he lost his job as a teacher for indiscretions with youth, with local youth, which was you know, a case that was pressed by local parents in ways that seemed somewhat dubious. But in any case, in great shame and in great haste, he and his mother fled the region to Rome, lived in real poverty for a number of years as his mother cleaned houses and Pasolini served as a teacher before he broke into the Roman literary scene as a poet. And so in terms of his eventual, the resonances between his work and Arte Povera, which I'll talk about, in a way, he never left that peasant Eden that was Friuli. It was a region that was, you know, with respect to the rest of Italy, backward. And that is a word that he would have, he did in fact prize greatly. For him, you know, one of Marxism's great promises was this, not only a kind of honoring of history, but a sense of maintaining a genuine relationship to the working class, to the subproletariat, in ways that rejected our you know, notions of quote unquote economic progress and development. And so that is, you know, you spoke about Pasolini's the polemical aspects of his work and his personhood, and you're absolutely right, to the extent that some of, interestingly enough, some of those of Pasolini's kind of ideological penchants for the peasantry, for an Italy untouched by consumerism, for this rejection of development, has actually been latched onto by neo-fascist and right-wing groups in Italy, as essentially saying, see, you know, Pasolini was elevating this Italy that was unspoiled by, you know, urban decadence and, you know, the land of immigrants. And, you know, this is the real heart of Italy is this Bluten, Boden, blood and soil, right? And of course, Pasolini, in aesthetic terms and even in that personal affective terms, his connection to the land in that way was put to completely different ideological ends. But there is inside it a kernel of conservatism, which can be bent to radically different ends of the political spectrum. But, you know, he essentially, as I said, grafted that love of the peasantry onto these communities, marginalized communities of subproletariat, you know, not working class because they didn't even have work, communities on the outskirts of Rome. And, you know, early on, he wrote one of the scenes in Fellini's Knights of Cabiria. He was essentially the curator of Roman slang and Roman nightlife, of prostitutes and johns and loafers and petty thieves. You know, Fellini essentially hired him to be the expert on that world in a scene from Notti di Cabiria, you know, before turning his own hand at directing in his first film, Accattone, which is the word Accattone means beggar. And it was essentially a look at this, you know, subproletariat Roman idler who wants to make a new life and get a job and stop being a john and exploiting prostitutes. And it's essentially about how that quest to become a kind of good working class, class conscious, bearing individual, in fact, leads to disaster. And there's a very similar theme in Mamma Roma. So so for Pasolini, this attachment to poverty and to this rejection of development and progress in capitalist terms led him to fixate upon a world that was, in his view, unsullied by the development of capitalism. And again, before we get into his relationship to Arte Povera, it helps to frame things in some historical terms. Italy, which was a largely agrarian country for, you know, the better half of the 20th century, after World War II, underwent what is generally referred to as the economic boom or the economic miracle, not unlike Germany during the same years. So, you know, beginning in 1958, in the wake of the Marshall Plan, which America pursued in helping Italy with a great deal of aid, materially, financially, also using it as a bulwark against the growing communist bloc. Because remember, Italy borders Slovenia, right? So it became a very strategic political check against this communist East. Italy also had one of the largest communist classes in the post-war period of any Western democracy. I believe the largest, in fact. And so this American kind of hegemonic struggle to kind of win the hearts of Italians and of Italy led to not only a great deal of economic support, but also abetted this economic boom, which saw Italy explode in financial and economic terms. It saw, you know, the percentage of individuals with indoor toilets and washing machines explode exponentially. And these are sort of everyday banal things which perhaps we take for granted, but the material life of the ordinary, particularly urban-dwelling Italian, was irrevocably transformed in the span of something like 5 years. And whereas for many, and indeed for many it was, a salutary change, that Italy was finally kind of entering into modernity in a sense, that it was finally becoming a quote-unquote developed nation, was for Pasolini an absolute catastrophe. He spoke of it in what he called anthropological terms, that essentially rampant consumerism was transforming Italy's way of life on every level, not only the material one, but also the linguistic one. So, you know, the highways that now linked various provinces in Italy, what those highways didn't connect, the television did, right? Essentially, in his view, increasingly leveling the incredible diversity of Italian culture and dialect. You know, as you know, Jana, as an Italian, you know, most Italian, you know, or in the mid-century, certainly more than half of Italians didn't speak Italian at home. They spoke dialect. And still today, that is greatly the case. But Pasolini saw this, what he saw as a kind of technocratic leveling of an incredible, a heterogeneous array of cultures into an increasingly homogenized and singular culture on the level of consumerism, basically. And so for him, aesthetics became a kind of project to rescue that world as it was increasingly infected by capitalist plenty. And he uses that pathological medical terminology again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's fair to call it a sullying, right? As you said, that this natural, organic, blood and soil Italy, of which the Friuli is certainly a demonstration, is becoming this like global urbanized kind of soup.
Yes. You know? And it's important to point out that, you know, his attachment to the land was in no way linked to nationalism, right? So it wasn't it was in no way, it might be contiguous to certain fascist notions of a kind of purity of the land. But of course, Pasolini was a profoundly lifelong anti-fascist in pretty much every way. And so his version of this land was precisely about its local, non-hegemonic identity, right? That it was about the regional and about the indissoluble particularities of these different regions and their dialects. And so his attachment to the land in that sense was a rejection of modernity, at least as it was being carried out in neo-capitalist terms. And as I said, he remained a lifelong communist, despite having been kicked out of the Communist Party. He remained at odds with the communist officialdom for the rest of his life, and yet supported the party actively in pretty much all aspects of his aesthetic engagements. And, you know, I should note that, again, just to a degree, personal biographical background bears upon this. His brother, Guido Alberto, was actually killed during World War II, not by the Nazi fascist occupying army in the north, but actually by fellow communists. So the internecine differences between aspects of the left and even within communist forces bore upon Pasolini's particularly embattled relationship to leftist politics, as much as he was also completely execrated by the right. So that is the other, paradox that really interests me and drew me to Pasolini, was that he was as much of an outsider to leftist communist politics as he was a complete abomination for both the radical right and the Italian bourgeoisie.
I mean, this is just such a wonderful demonstration, right, of this paradox that you that's at the center of this work. It's wonderful. Okay, where are we? Arte povera.
So, yeah, I mean, so basically, through these case studies, I looked at different aspects, in particular instances of Pasolini at once using elements of avant-garde aesthetics and holding them at bay. So, you know, the irony of the fact that, for example, he hated abstract expressionism and saw it as a kind of literalization of neo-capitalism's blithe kind of rejection of history and historical time. And yet, he painted some abstract canvases himself. And some of his cinematic strategies from his kind of repeated invocation of desert scenes in a number of different films to certain aspects of his own film theory engaged with abstraction in some pretty nuanced and profound ways. So, you know, that's one of those, again, paradoxes in a particular actual case, right? The same with Pop. I mean, he was someone who saw the intrusion of popular fragments of consumerist life into the aesthetic realm as something, as kind of an instantiation of the fact that that culture had just given up at maintaining some sort of transcendent realm for art, and yet he in many of his films includes what we would call certain pop elements. At one point in his poetry in the early 60s, he sort of has this fragment where he talks about an advertisement for toothpaste, which is, you know, in some ways it's the exception that proves the rule, because Pasolini was generally not attentive to kind of aspects of modernity and the modern world, like advertising, technology, etc. But there are a number of different instances where he engages with what we would call pop art, and his he reviews a show by Andy Warhol. There are a number of different particular ways in which he at once kind of uses pop and criticizes it at the same time. With Arte Povera, the relationship is somewhat different, to the extent that it's the one neo-avant-garde movement of the 60s with which Pasolini shared a great deal, even if, as I mentioned earlier, he was likely kind of unaware or unconcerned with its development. And Arte Povera, I should note, was formed by the critic Germano Celant in 1967. And the term Arte Povera, which in English means poor art, it basically means a number of different things. But it basically, on its most basic level, means an art that is made with the simplest of means, that is no longer bound to the gallery space or institutional framing, to the traditional paradigms of painting and sculpture, but also incorporates process, accident, gravity, which uses materials from dirt and sand to rock to also synthetic materials. So now, like Pasolini, Arte Poveristi, as we call them, those who kind of practiced Arte Povera, and again, it wasn't an actual avant-garde to the extent that it didn't necessarily have a manifesto which various artists signed. A number of artists kind of came and went. Many of them exhibited together, but a lot of non-Poveristi exhibited with the group. But one of their chief concerns was this transformation of Italy on the level of both this economic miracle and the consumerist revolution which it had achieved. And, you know, again, this is the same kind of problem that Pasolini was thinking about and engaged with on an even more aggressive level. The idea that, yes, a revolution has happened, but it is not the revolution that people on the left had hoped. It's a revolution of plenty, of complacency, of passivity. Guy Debord is doing a lot of very sort of similar things with Situationism in France in the 50s and 60s. And I talk a little bit about the resonance between the projects of Debord and Pasolini. But some of the chief sympathies between Pasolini and Arte Povera were a sympathy for elements of craft, of the local. What one artist, Yannis Kounellis, who was a Greek-born Italian artist, called the slang of matter. So this idea that even materials can have a kind of slang rather than official institutional pigeonholed uses, right? This idea of engaging with the peasant world, with what Celant at one point calls the medieval world. And again, that's a kind of pre-modern or early modern paradigm. So essentially a sympathy for the unsophisticated, for, for art, which also operates not on the level of the mind, but also of the body, of the sensory world. So Kounellis would incorporate into some of his installations, for example, burlap sacks and coal, or ground coffee, so that when you walk into these spaces, you are engaged with the work not just on the visual level, but also on a bodily sensory level, which takes us a little bit out of the intellectual realm, right, into another form of engagement with work. And that is, in some ways, what Pasolini wanted to do both with his poetry and with his cinema. There's at the start of his own film Oedipus Rex, which is inevitably partly autobiographical. In fact, it ends in the city of Bologna, where Pasolini had studied at university, and the opening scene in many ways is an allusion to his own childhood, but the camera lingers on this canopy of leaves for several seconds, and essentially telling us that Oedipus as a child, this is his sort of vision of the world on a primal bodily level, that it's not just about sight, but also the sound of leaves, their rustling, what it means to be inside of a body. And so those phenomenological elements, emerge to some degree in Pasolini's work, much more strikingly in Arte Povera. Pasolini was not interested in kind of the accidents or the vagaries of process, right? His films are all very hieratic and planned. You know, he says at one point, "I hate naturalism. I want to plan everything," right? So, hence his continued engagement for painting, for figurative painting, which, you know, is the kind of thing that Arte Povera is trying to throw out the door, saying, you know, we don't need these traditional art forms to be the way that we engage with the world aesthetically. And yet Pasolini clung to them stubbornly. And yet there are so many, not just visual resonances between his work and Arte Povera, but also a kind of affective and ethnographic love for the unofficial, for the non-urban, for this artist Pino Pascali has an installation which he did in 1968 called Agricultural Tools, and it's basically just these tools that he himself kind of made out of wood and straw, and it inevitably conjures up the notion of the artist as craftsman, but also the artist as peasant, right? As identifying, in a sense, with these individuals on a on even a bodily level. And so, that's it. You know, those are some of the points of contact, I guess, with Arte Povera, which I explore in that chapter. And you know, one final element I would say is, like many elements of modernism, and here again, Pasolini ends up being very typically modernist, even as he's trying to reject certain elements of modernity, is that he identifies extensively with what we would now call kind of the global South. And he starts out really fixated on Italy's South, and, you know, uses Neapolitan dialect in his film of the Decameron, for example, so kind of contaminating the pure Tuscan with Neapolitan dialect, but also, Italy's South, because it was agrarian and quote unquote backward, was for him for a long time this holdout against Italy's economic boom and its consumerist revolution. And as that boom kind of extended to the entire country, Pasolini began pursuing these pre-modern and prehistorical spaces abroad. So he made dozens of trips to Africa. He famously went to India with Alberto Moravia and Elsa Morante. He made a film in Yemen. He had a film planned on South America. He wrote a draft for a film which he called Notes for a Film on the Third World. So, like Arte Povera, he was drawn to the quote-unquote third world precisely because of its unsophisticatedness and its perceived outsiderness to contemporary European Western modernity. And, you know, he also was driven to that extent by his love for the writings of Antonio Gramsci, the most prominent communist theorist who was imprisoned and killed by the fascist regime, whose dream and whose life project intellectually was to unite the agrarian peasant South with the industrial North in Italy, and to have both of those elements of the working class who had traditionally been held apart by elements of Italian politics be united in their struggle against capitalism and the bourgeoisie. And so that quote-unquote Southern strategy, in a sense, was also informs Pasolini's work by way of Gramsci as well.
There's so many threads I want to go into, so many things I want to talk about. The centrality of language. I want us to sit for a while and talk about Friuli, the dialect of the Friuli. Yes. And Neapolitan dialects. I want us to talk about the importance of kind of the visceral and bodily exploration of art, how this relates to earlier historical discussions of the natural. And we do not in this little podcast have time for it. So you and I are going to have to talk about it after. Okay. And everyone else is going to have to talk about, you know, read the book and then, you know, send our own email. He'd be happy to talk to you.
Absolutely.
All right. I learned about Arte Povera quite a bit while I was reading this book, and I'm very I was fascinated by it. It makes so much sense that you know, Pasolini, it seems like a place he would go, right? It seems like something, and I can that he would really that would suit him, but then it's this thing he's completely antithetical to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, Arte Povera was in many ways about breaking the frame, about, you know, having art be improvised to a certain extent, performative, not subjective to the normal spatial and temporal confines of how we traditionally approach aesthetics. And Pasolini was, you know, exactly the opposite. It was all about planning and framing and symmetry and kind of hieratic bodies framed in ways that emulated early modern altarpieces, Romanesque sculpture. And so again, this sort of lingering dedication to the figurative, what he would call the plastic world. But yeah, I mean, there are
It's natural, it's bodily, it's this very organic, natural. I keep saying natural, but
yeah. Yeah, I mean, so there are instances where the elements of the kind of framed and perfectly almost hermetic elements of Pasolini's aesthetic get interrupted. So, for example, on the opening credits of his film Mamma Roma, there is a fly which lands on the names as they're being listed. And he kept that sequence in where we see the fly land on what were obviously credits in sort of real space. And it's this, in some ways, it's this interruption, this reminder that the film is in process and being made in an actual space. And so, you know, and yet he kept it in there. So there are elements where you know, and as I point out in the book, there are other sequences. For example, in his notes for a film on India and in his notes towards an African Orestes, which were both kind of part travelogue, part exploration of sites that he wanted to make films in, part kind of documentary, part meta-documentary. He homes in on, at one point, just a clump of leaves. He homes in on rudimentary wooden tools in an African village. And these are precisely the kinds of things that the Arte Poveristi were interested in simulating and in engaging with, again, precisely because they were unsophisticated and seemingly outside of history, because Italy's contemporary history, its contemporary reality, seemed to be being made over into the world of corporate design, technocratic language. And so this being drawn to slang, to the quote-unquote third world, was a way of holding that brave new gleaming modernity at bay.
Nice. All right. I know that this does not relate to the work at all, but do you have an opinion on his death? Was it that single guy?
There have been a couple of really incisive books written on this in recent years. I think it's one of those things, sort of like the Piazza Fontana bombing in Milan, that will remain a kind of open wound in Italian modernity in ways that are inevitably unresolved. I do think that it seems highly unlikely that this individual would have acted alone. In fact, he recanted his testimony at a later date in prison. Pasolini was too prominent, too smart, and too inconvenient an individual and a body. And again, the prominence of his body, how much it went against the grain of Italy and Italian modernity in a lot of ways. He was an openly gay man who actively played soccer and was unabashed about his sexuality, and yet wanted nothing to do with what we would call identity politics and the politics of gay rights. And yet he was this, he was inconvenient, essentially, for Italian, a narrative of Italian modernity. And so it seems unlikely that other forces would not have wanted him disappeared.
Sure. It seems it just convenient, right? It's just entirely too convenient.
Yes. Yeah.
I sound like a conspiracy theorist here.
But the details of the like you said, we can't go into them here, but the details of the case are really, Pasolini was a very strong man, and the idea that this young guy would be able to attack and essentially, beat him, bludgeon him brutally to death on his own is in itself highly unlikely. But when framed by the larger picture, which is that Pasolini had all kinds of dirt on contemporary politicians and the government in ways that made him a kind of sitting duck, at that point, it really becomes pretty much impossible not to believe that there were larger forces in play.
Right on. All right. So, Dr. Marjan, what is next for you? More Pasolini, back to Chirico, something entirely new?
All three. I am co-editing a book with my colleague Alessandro Giamme. It's basically an anthology of Pasolini's writings on art history, which will come out in 2022, which is the centenary of his birth, also the centenary of the March on Rome. Interestingly enough, Pasolini was born the year that Mussolini seized power. But so that's coming out with Verso in 2022. I am writing a second book on De Chirico for Yale University Press on De Chirico's afterlives in the 20th century, particularly in terms of representations of architecture. So it's called Blueprints and Ruins, the Architectural Afterlives of De Chirico from the Avant-Garde to Postmodernism. And then I'm working on another project on Futurism and Sculpture, which I'm kind of excited about. So I'm teaching both of my classes right now on Futurism and Politics, and so it becomes a kind of way to read the movement through just one of its kind of many aesthetic concerns, which was sculpture, and to think about how sculpture, how central it was to the Futurist project, and in some ways how emblematic it was of these various ideological imperatives, like the fascist imagery of flight and this kind of virile embodiment, and but also kind of forerunner of what we would call kinetic sculpture. So a number of different areas in which Futurist sculpture, which has been relatively unexamined, prove central to the movement.
Oh, that sounds so great. I'm so excited. This sounds wonderful. Look at you, busy and amazing. Ara, my old friend, it was so great to talk to you today.
Yeah, I appreciate it so much. It's so wonderful to be able to talk about this with a friend. And you're such an eloquent interlocutor, even listening to some of the other podcasts. I mean, it's rare to find someone who can put people at ease, but also ask the right questions. So I thank you.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, there we go. So next time, for the next book, you'll talk to me again then.
Absolutely.
And ideally, we'll get to play together on one side of the Atlantic or the other
that's
soon.
Right. Yes.
All right. So. Until then, though, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jana.
Bye-bye.